Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Welcome to the Work in Progress seminars. This is the second in this year's set of seminars on work and progress in the social sciences and the social studies more generally. These seminars have been going for 15 years, and the purpose of the seminars is twofold. First, to provide a stimulating arena where people doing research in all kinds of social studies can get friendly feedback. So they are supposed to be interactive seminars where there's plenty of discussion. And the second purpose is to act as an interface between the Maltese community and the University of Malta. So we welcome outsiders just as we welcome undergraduates and postgraduate students to come to these seminars. Last week was our first seminar for this semester. It featured Virginia Montefort, a PhD student at EHESS in Paris, who spoke on her research. It was Remembering the Past, the Narrative and Memory in Contemporary Maltese Politics. Next week, our speaker will be Dr. Jean-Paul De Luca from the Department of Philosophy, who will be speaking on his research into the philosophy of Francisco Suarez, who was one of the founders of the philosophy of international law. In 2 weeks' time, we will be having Professor Mary Darmanin, and Mary will be reading a paper entitled Changing Maltese Religious Identities. Is Malta the exception to the exception? So if you're interested in that intriguing title, come along in 2 weeks' time. Tonight, it is my great pleasure to welcome, and I may say welcome back, Professor Vicky Ann Cremona. Vicky Ann is one of the founders of the Work in Progress seminars, and it was through her good initiatives that these seminars first began to be recorded. So actually, you can hear all the seminar papers and all the seminar discussions back until about 2004. You can hear them on the website of Campus Radio FM. So if you go to either, if you Google Campus FM, University of Malta, you'll be able to hear Professor Cremona's talk tonight and past talks going back a very long time indeed. Professor Cremona will be speaking to the title Fancy Dress, Rank and Dignity, Power and Play in Carnival Balls from 1800 to the early 1900s. Well, for most of you, Professor Cremona needs no introduction, but for those of you who may be less clear, Professor Cremona was the head of theater studies at the University of Malta from 1992 until 2004. From 2004 until 2005, she was a visiting scholar at Lucy Cavendish College, University of Cambridge. From 2005 to 2009, she was Malta's ambassador to Paris. And since 2009, Vicky Ann is Malta's ambassador to Tunisia. So Vicky Ann, we really look forward to what you have to say.
I'm just going to give you a little idea of the way I'm going to be developing this talk. I'll be giving a very small methodological framework. Then I'm going to be talking about the clubs, balls at the clubs, balls at the Borsa, balls at the Palace, popular balls, balls at the Royal Opera House, other public balls, and the little perspective after the war, even though my subject really ends up around about the 1935. In trying to define the term theatrical event, Wilmar Sauter uses the term cultural contexts, which refer to the socio-political aspect, both in relation to its content and in the way it is presented. What is examined is how the cultural context shapes or influences the event. My working hypothesis for this paper is to show how the event itself can reflect bigger political undercurrents. And therefore, in this context, I see the expansion of the theatrical event by using this as a tool for cultural history. What I would like to do in my paper is to read the event by looking through the lens of cultural history. That is, to take an event down to its minor details and show how this can be revealing of the deeper political macro forces at play. The idea is to show how society is tightly controlled also through the establishment of codes, rules, and etiquettes which are not necessarily of its choosing, but imposed from above. The way things are imposed and the way people react to these impositions also tell a story about macro history from the micro historical point of view. Therefore, the event is seen as the micro medium to explain macro historical forces at work. Cultural historians such as Leroy Ladurie in his Carnival at Romans have used theatrical events to illustrate their historical hypotheses. But the approach to that type of historical analysis was to start out from the event in order to examine the economic, social, and political realities of the time and the rich possibilities offered. By the way, the event is staged, are not examined through a theatrical perspective. I would like to remain within a thick description of the theatrical event in order to show how social and economic tensions can be reflected within the event itself, where the theatrical qualities of the event are a clear indication in themselves of the reality behind. The common ground of cultural history, as defined by Peter Burke and the theatrical event, is, I quote, a concern with the symbolic and its interpretation. The idea is to look at specific theatrical events in Malta and see how these become the terrain, on the one hand, to express political domination, and on the other hand, to express national identity. I will therefore shift the element of symbol from the theatrical context to the political one. I shall be focusing on one particular type of event, carnival balls in Malta in the 19th and 20th centuries, early 20th centuries, at a time when the islands were one of the only two islands, but the two European colonies, three if one is also to count Gibraltar, in the vastness of the British Empire. Unfortunately, this paper is still a work in progress, as I have been unable to develop both the aspect of the popular balls and, more importantly, the theoretical framework surrounding the thick description I provide here. But I have tried to lay down the foundations of an analysis that should eventually cover the whole British period in Malta from 1800 to 1964. The British arrived in Malta at the beginning of the 19th century, just when their policies of expansion were beginning to take a new turn. Britain's strength was built on its affirmation as a major military and naval power, with at the time probably the strongest navy in Europe and in the world. The loss of the American colonies in the 1770s had already been made up for through more intense trade relations, and Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and India were under British rule or control. The British had taken advantage of the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars to seize from the French various strategic territories across the globe. The Maltese had obtained British help when, after rising against their new French occupiers, they had asked for aid from the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, because although dominated by the Knights of St. John for almost three centuries, they fell under the power of Ferdinand I of Naples. The king had asked Lord Nelson, who happened to be visiting his mistress, the beautiful Lady Hamilton, whose husband was an archaeologist, obviously digging at the dig in Herculaneo at the time, to relieve the Maltese in his name. But once on the spot, the British quickly appraised the island's worth as a strategic port for their fleet and a good base for their army. Consequently, they assumed full power over Malta, initially with the blessing of the inhabitants. The Maltese had believed that they would be granted self-government by the British, but they soon had to take stock of the fact that this was not going to happen very quickly. In fact, it would not be granted before 1921. 19th century British attitude to the Maltese can be summed up in the following observation, made almost at the turn of the century by an American traveller to Malta. I quote, "The British government seems willing not to interfere to any considerable extent in the domestic or religious affairs of the islands. An unequalled military and naval station is secured to England in the Mediterranean. That is the main point. The loyalty of the people to the British Queen is quite a secondary consideration. Were the Maltese to break out in a rebellious mood, they would be instantly and ruthlessly crushed. Their position would in no way be improved. The privileges which they enjoy would be greatly curtailed, and their political condition would assimilate to that of the subjected and downtrodden tribes of India." End quote. The extent to which the British were prepared to interfere in Maltese affairs can be witnessed not only in the macro-historical events affecting the island, but also in micro-historical realities such as Carnival, because the insidious ways in which power is established and affirmed in micro-realities is indicative of a pervasive general trend. British attitudes vis-à-vis the Maltese Carnival evolved through the years. Carnival was a form of merriment that the 19th century British were not acquainted with. The first time the Maltese celebrated Carnival in 1802, a confidential report by Charles Cameron, dated 18th March of that year, mentions the celebration of Carnival, which it would seem had not been celebrated for 7 years. Cameron reports that the measure had met with the greatest popularity, as he states, I quote, "The Maltese bear the most childish enthusiasm for this celebration." The use of childish seems to denote two things: the fact that the British do not understand or associate with Carnival celebrations, probably the ones outdoors, and in typical colonial fashion, that anything that was not understood was deemed inferior and demeaned. Things appear differently from the Maltese perspective. Up to the 1850s, the predominant culture was Italian. The government gazette was issued in the Italian language, and the Maltese were having to familiarize themselves for the first time in their history with British and Protestant traditions and customs. Interestingly, though, it would seem that other forms of carnival revelry were more easily adopted by the British, probably because they were more consonant with British tradition. This was particularly the case for balls. Balls were an important part of social life in Britain, especially that of the higher classes. They were also an important form of entertainment in the colonies. British governors gave balls at different times of the year, and masked balls at the governor's residence were a prime feature of Carnival, particularly for the elite. Social aspiration under the British found fulfillment in Carnival by being invited to high society balls, in particular that given by the governor. Balls were an integral part of social life for the Maltese higher-ranking classes before the British arrived to the islands. The knights gave balls for Carnival in their different auberges, and balls were also held on various occasions, including Carnival, at the Manuel Theatre, where, as in other Baroque theatres, the parterre floor would be winched up to the level of the stage to allow for more room for dancing. At the time, people normally wore masks to Carnival balls, except when disruptions during the dancing would oblige the authorities to disallow masking. 10 years after the arrival of the British in 1810, Domier, a medical doctor, wrote, I quote, "Some married officers, as well as gentlemen employed in the civil branch of the government, and wealthy merchants, keep good houses, and vie with each other in giving dinners, balls, and card parties, especially in winter and during the carnival." The author's description of the amount of balls organized throughout the year shows clearly that balls were a popular form of entertainment that was shared between British and Maltese society. I quote, "There is a public ball every fortnight in the palace, one Wednesday given by the civil governor and the next by the military commander, to which both English and Maltese who appear in society are invited. The dance beginning at 8 o'clock and being over at midnight. Those who do not like to dance enjoy refreshments, society, music, or cards. 2, in the summer, the same society meets every Wednesday at Sant Antonio, where they dance in the open air in the garden. 3, some married officers of the staff, some of the regiments, messes of whole regiments, Maltese families, British merchants, and gentlemen employed in the civil department now and then give balls. Besides the public masked balls in the theatre, at the end of the carnival, offer frequent opportunities for the amateurs of this amusement. End quote. On the 20th February 1824, 22 years after the first British mention of carnival celebrations in Malta, a notice in the printed organ of the colonial government, the Malta Government Gazette, shows that the carnival balls had been integrated into British moors. The notice states that the last of the 5 subscription balls for the season would be given on Monday, 1st of March, at the Auberge de Castille, then the British Army headquarters, and would consist of a fancy dress ball. Other public balls, as well as private ones, were also organized, and the Maltese gentile families combined a mixture of outdoor revelry and indoor entertainment, which seemed to be disappearing with the increased organization of official balls, causing a Maltese anti-British newspaper to write in 1856, I quote, "Where are the public balls? And where the private ones that many families used to organize during the carnival season? Where are the masked groups made up of respectable families which could be seen in the night?" End quote. What is certain is that by the middle of the century, carnival balls had become a means to identify those who the British considered as Maltese higher-ranking civil society. As Sir George Cornwall Lewis, one of the royal commissioners appointed to investigate Maltese affairs, was to state rather emphatically, being identified as belonging to the elite was a source of social preoccupation. I quote, "The 2 main evils of Malta are, for the upper classes, practical exclusion from office, brutal treatment by the English in society, and for the lower classes, overpopulation." End quote. The British very ably summoned support for themselves among the higher echelons of society by acknowledging the titles of the Maltese aristocracy as early as 1813. British governors and officials and certain members of the Maltese aristocracy frequented each other, to the extent that much of the Maltese nobility abandoned the use of Italian, the language of polite society, for English. This pro-British stance was also adopted by higher-ranking civil servants or political councillors until the formation of political parties in the 1880s, when the language question, or rather the choice between Italian and English, and eventually Maltese as the language of administration and the courts, became a central theme in Maltese politics. In effect, the British did not regard with quite the same benevolence the middle-class intelligentsia, who were far more involved in the island's political scene and ready to question and criticize their actions, as well as to claim rights to their own governance. The pro-British attitude of certain sectors of society was denounced in an article that appeared during the carnival period of 1864, which claimed that carnival took place 365 days a year. I quote, "The governor puts on a mask. He is all smiles for those other constantly masked figures who call themselves councillors. Also masked are the other employees who creep around the idol of power. And also masked are those Maltese gentlemen who affect an English pronunciation, rejecting their own." End quote. The degree of social proximity with the British played a preponderant role on social distinction. The traveller Ballou makes the point very explicitly in his observations, I quote, "It is natural that there should be a certain exclusiveness observed between the Maltese families and those of the official English residents. Caste, so to express it, is not under the arbitrary conditions in which it exists in other colonies such as India, but it is not unknown here." End quote. I'm now going to talk about balls at the clubs. Balls provided an excellent opportunity for a certain class of Maltese to mix with English officers, thereby affirming public acknowledgement of their social importance. Il Filantropo Maltese of 1857 informs that four main balls were given in Carnival, which were attended by some respectable families, while another section of the population stood outside, watching people alight from their carriages in order to admire the beautiful costumes. The venues of the balls already provided a strong indication of the distinction between British and Maltese. Following the establishment of the Malta Union Club, a social club that in typical colonial fashion was set up by and for the higher echelons of British and foreign society in Malta, British Army Carnival celebrations were moved from the Army headquarters to the Auberge de Provence, where the club was housed from 1826 to 1954. A few years after its foundation, this British gentleman's club had 80 members and a few honorary members. In 1831, their list of members includes only one Maltese, a judge listed as Satariano Dr. Giovanni Battista, Dr. Giobat anyway, one of Her Majesty's judges, who was described by Lewis, the British Member of Parliament who had visited Malta in 1836, as a judge of excellent sense and in other respects, a sound and able man. In 1880, the number of members had increased to 150. The Union Club was generally forbidden to Maltese, however genteel their origins, to the extent that in 1887, an anti-British local newspaper commented about two letters which had appeared in the London Times and that had rejected the possibility of Maltese forming part of the Union Club by stating, I quote, "The members of the Union Club, all English, military and naval officials, do not want to admit Maltese as members in that club," end quote. Only a few select families were invited to this club for Carnival, and people, as I said before, would stand in the street to watch the guests alight from their carriages. An article in Il Filantropo Maltese reports that on Tuesday, 17th February 1857, from various carriages that stopped in front of the Auberge de Provence, from time to time there alighted, and I quote, "a Turk, a knight, an Albanian, and a pretty young lady dressed after the French fashion," end quote. In contrast to the selection imposed on Maltese attendees, the club was thrown open to foreign officials visiting the island, as in 1908, when the officials of the Austro-Hungarian squadron that was docked at the port were invited to the club carnival ball. To counter exclusion from the club, Maltese higher middle classes opened a similar club for Maltese gentlemen called the Circolo Maltese, and then the Casino Maltese. Probably, as from 1876, they too organized the carnival ball, which vied with the British balls in splendor. A short comment by an anti-British newspaper about the 1885 carnival ball, organized by the club, reveals the latent intent to place Maltese identity on a par with British upper-class Moors, vis-à-vis the highest British representative on the island, who was regularly invited to preside the ball. I quote, "From our end, we cannot but praise the members of the casino for the splendid success of this ball, in particular the management committee that spared no effort to honor Her Excellency, who, in a way that was befitting and consistent with customs of Maltese society." In this case, they are referring to Lady Simmons, the wife of the governor, who had presided the ball in lieu of her husband because he was ill. A notice in a 1907 newspaper states that although persons could appear in disguise, masks would not be allowed, possibly in order to disallow anybody under cover of a full mask to break the rules of decorum the club members were so proud of. I shall be coming back to this theme of disguise a little later, But before I do that, I would like to report something that I found very amusing in a 1935 report about a ball in the Casino Maltese, the following year, the ball was said to be, as usual, a tremendous success, with over 2,000 guests and many amusing companies participating in the general atmosphere of fun. A particularly daring company, which included the mischievous Miss Mona DePiro and her sister, Marquess Barbara Zimmerman, actually had a full-size bathing machine labeled Mrs. Grundy's bathing machine brought into the ballroom, which on being opened proved to contain a number of masked ladies in bathing costumes of the 1900 era and men in sailor hats with witty line written on their bands and striped jerseys and blue trousers. This is just a little anecdote I thought was good. So, the Borsa Ball. Another popular ball was that at the Borsa, that is the Chamber of Commerce, that had been founded in 1848 by the Irish governor, Moore O'Farrell. Attending this ball was a sign of distinction for anyone Maltese, as the members of the Borsa were among the richest businessmen and merchants in Malta. When reporting on this ball in 1859, a journalist was moved to exclaim, I quote, "There is money in abundance, and many can make abundant waste of it." Proof of this may be seen at the balls that took place at the Casino de la Borsa. Rarely had costumes so rich and splendid been seen as at that ball. Whoever is associated to the Borsa must necessarily have a big purse, end quote. The popularity of this ball, to which the British members were also invited, grew to such an extent that towards the end of the century, publicity specified that guests had to show their invitation at the door, which leads one to suppose that some people had tried to gatecrash, perhaps in order to play the social game of see and be seen, and consequently be identified as forming part of the social elite. In 1935, the numbers at the Exchange Ball, as it had become to be known, had swelled. 1,200 invitations were issued that year, and by that time, members of Malta's elite had no compunction in appearing comically dressed, such as five of Malta's leading doctors, Professor Elul, Dr. Toledo, Professor Vassallo, Dr. Assa, and Dr. Borge, appearing as a party of Russians hidden behind big black beards. The Palace Ball. The most important ball was obviously that given, generally on a Monday, by the governor at his official residence, the former Grand Master's Palace. An idea of the numbers attending the ball is provided in 1878. A newspaper informs that about 1,000 invitations had been sent out and over 800 guests had turned up. According to a note by the Foreign Office dated 1910, the budget for the ball was then set at £500. It was usually managed by the governor's staff and two captains from the Royal Highlanders, while the police force managed the traffic outside. The musical entertainment was of a high standard, and in 1899 it is specified that the maestro of the Royal Opera House, Professor Cavalier Lancellotti, directed the music himself. Dances included various quadrilles and fashionable dances, such as gavotte and later waltzes, polkas, as well as other dances better known in Britain, such as a barn dance and a shadow dance. All British officials were present at this ball and wore their military or naval uniforms. In 1890, a new unpopular rule forbade citizens to disguise themselves as military or naval officers, as, I quote, "they had done from time immemorial during Carnival," end quote. Moreover, I quote again, "the officers, non-commissioned officers and men of the Royal Regiment of Malta Militia," which had only been raised a few months before, actually, "protested against the discriminatory," I quote, "gratuitous insult inflicted upon them by forbidding them to appear in uniform during Carnival, while the members of the regular forces, the Royal Malta Artillery included, were obliged to appear in uniform during the 3 days," end quote. Other invitees were to come in fancy dress. Under certain governors, masks were allowed, whereas they were forbidden under others. Various descriptions of the costumes worn at the balls were given in different newspapers. An illustrated weekly newspaper shows a picture depicting a fancy dress ball held on the 12th February 1877, which was attended by the Duchess of Edinburgh, and it informs its readers that all the English society and leading Maltese families were present, and that the novel disguises included, I quote, afternoon tea, bluebeard, and beer bottle. That attracted the Duchess's attention. The Maltese newspapers in Italian generally mentioned the fine costumes, but rarely did they give any description, except with regards to the ones worn by children at children's balls. The British newspapers, however, especially the Daily Malta Chronicle, systematically published descriptions of the finest costumes, as well as lists of costumes worn at the ball, generally supplied by the wearers themselves. The list for the Carnival Ball of 1889 has a curious mix of typical carnival costumes, such as Adieu Smith's Fisher Girl, or inspired from paintings, such as Arbouin, Mr. G.B., Berger, and in brackets, Watteau. Others more difficult to imagine, either inspired by popular novels of the time, such as Andrew's Miss, Tour du Monde en 80 Jours. Now, remember that the book had actually appeared in French in 1873. Or Cunning Bruce, Mr. Black Watch Curried Rice. This type of list provided the excuse for satirical newspapers to publish parallel fictitious lists of personalities, particularly politicians, wearing costumes that indicated some bad or ridiculous trait. In the newspaper Gli Animali Parlanti in 1875 published a list that included the governor, Sir Charles Strawbensy, as a 19th century cook, Sir Adrian Dingley, the Crown Advocate, who at the time was certainly the most powerful man in Malta, as Bismarck up to his neck. And the Honourable Inglot, obviously Ferdinando Inglot, the head of a government department and member of the Council of Government, who defended the teaching of the English language in schools, as a laico zoccolante, a variation to the usual expression frate zoccolante, that is a minor friar wearing clogs, to a lay person wearing clogs, in other words, someone creating a useless cluttering noise. Maltese critical attitude towards its politicians also showed a certain diffidence as to their professional capabilities. As a newspaper, from time immemorial. As a newspaper reveals in an ironic comment with regard to their carnival apparel at the governor's ball, and I quote, "The major attraction was to see our members of parliament dressed as serious persons, a brand new costume for them." End quote. Newspaper reports of the time, however, also seem to indicate that a whole sector of Maltese middle-class society chose not to attend the governor's balls because they did not like the idea of appearing in disguise. The fact of being obliged to wear a fancy dress costume to the ball appeared demeaning to high-ranking civil servants and citizens who would have opted for more sober attire. I quote, "The grand masked ball at the palace on Monday was brilliantly successful for the abundance, the taste, the variety, and the wealth of disguises, which mixed with the golden military decorations and superb uniforms of English military and naval officials, produced a splendid effect indeed. Every year at this grand ball, the absence of the magistrature, of other civil servants, of nobles, and other important personages is deplored, the latter feeling that it is not decorous for their age or rank to disguise themselves, prefer to stay at home." End quote. Another newspaper makes fun of this attitude while taking a dig at the leading pro or anti-British politicians of the time. The writer, under the nom de plume Howlglass, states that the words appearing on the governor's invitations, fancy dress or uniform, prey upon the minds of many a pater familias who worry about what they are to wear for reasons of rank and decorum. I quote, "And it is indeed a matter of no little concern if he would avoid being laughed at. One can never be over careful about his appearance being in accordance with his age and rank in society. Fancy at a fancy dress ball. Grey-headed, three-scored yours truly, donning the national costume of Zeppu, or Sir Somebody Nobody appearing as Faust would be an unbearable incongruity. Simply shocking." End quote. The issue of costume and disguise became a symbol of rank and recognition for the Maltese, just as enforcing disguise was soon to become more manifestly a symbol of power for the British. In 1884, a Maltese weekly financial newspaper stated that the use of wearing disguises in the streets was slowly diminishing among the intelligentsia, who preferred to attend private balls at the ones in the clubs. Things came to a head, however, between the years 1891 and 1892, which were also the years when the Maltese will to move from representative government that had been granted through the 1887 constitution to responsible government was being demonstrated both in the Executive Council, the highest partly elected government body, and in the streets. On the 24th January 1891, the newspaper Public Opinion informed its readers that His Excellency has, I quote, that His Excellency has withdrawn the compulsory fancy dress, leaving the guests the option of appearing in costume or in the usual full dress. That year, the Duke of Cambridge, who was then Commander-in-Chief of the British Army, was in Malta and went to both the ball at the palace and the one at the Bursa. It would seem, however, that the fact that the Maltese had been given a choice was not a decision approved by one and all. The following year, the invitation to the palace ball bore the words, "full dress or fancy dress," and the Maltese guests took it to mean that once again they had been given a choice, as they interpreted full dress to mean full evening dress rather than full military dress. The fact that this was not the case and the consequences that derived from this misunderstanding were clearly exposed in public opinion, and I quote, "Some remarks were passed upon the costumes of these gentlemen as appeared in evening dress, and we have been assured that the matter has gone so far that gentlemen invited to the palace by His Excellency the Governor and Lady Smith, because they appeared in evening dress, were asked to give their name to one of the servants, no doubt by superior orders." End quote. The fact of having to give one's name at a fancy dress ball because one was not attired in the appropriate way is already embarrassing in itself. In 19th century eyes, the fact of having to give it to a servant rather than to an officer was certainly perceived as humiliating. Even more degrading was the fact that persons not wearing the appropriate attire, as determined by British power, risked not being allowed in. 2 years later, a letter signed by nom de plume civilian, printed in the same newspaper, informed that henceforth all invitations bore the instruction fancy dress or full dress uniform. The addition of the latter word clearly meant that all civilians had no choice but to wear fancy dress, a decision which moved the writer, probably who probably did not dare reveal his real name, to state in protest. I quote, "Why should Colonel A be given the choice between fancy dress and uniform, while the head of an important public department, such as the Superintendent of Public Works, or one of Her Majesty's judges, or a police magistrate, is obliged to put on his fancy dress and the penalty of being excluded from the ball, together with his wife and family, who cannot well go to the palace without him?" End of quote. Costume, or rather the obligation to wear one, can be seen as a means of subtly ensuring that Maltese bourgeois society remained fully aware of the fact that although it may have aspired to be considered as part of the Maltese elite, It could not hope to form part of the country's decisional powers, which remained squarely in British hands. As one newspaper states ironically when describing the atmosphere at the Palace Ball, there was much dancing, much yawning, and very much curving of the back. This state of affairs had changed radically by the early 1900s. In June 1903, a new constitution was proclaimed that effectively placed power once more fully into British hands. In contrast, Maltese men could dress as they pleased at the Palace Ball, as the dress code, published in the Daily Malta Chronicle of 1906, stipulated that male civilians were to wear court or fancy dress, while ladies were to appear in fancy dress. 2 years later, however, the rival newspaper Malta Le Sue Dipendenze was still complaining about the fact that invitations to the palace balls were still written in such a way as to ensure that bourgeois society was compelled to go in fancy dress, while the military, who a few years before were also obliged to wear the same carnival attire, were now exempted from doing so. In 1912, the same newspaper seems to imply a certain entente between governor and guests, as it, in its reports, it informs the public that everyone, without distinction, had to wear a costume. The governor and many of the guests had, in fact, appeared disguised as Knights of Malta. Meanwhile, the fight for proper representation in a well-functioning decisional body was still continuing, and elected members to the Executive Council had resigned due to the fact that they had no real power, given that decisions were dictated from above. Suspension of palace balls. The fact that the governor's ball was a British and not a Maltese celebration can also be seen by the fact that the celebration was easily suspended in cases of British concern. In 1901, no balls were given at the palace because of the death of Queen Victoria. The same occurred when Queen Alexandra passed away in 1926. In 1903, Lady Grenfell, the Governor General's wife, had postponed the children's ball because of the funeral of His Royal Highness Prince Alfred of Coburg, Duke of Edinburgh. In 1915, the ball was not held due to the war, and it would seem that carnival celebrations in the palace were never resumed after that. Balls could also be suspended for seemingly less preponderant matters. In 1903, Lord Grenfell did not give a ball because he was leaving the island. In 1908, the governor, Sir Leslie Rundell, proposed to cancel the ball due to budgetary limitations. In London, Mr. Cox's explanatory note to his superiors gives a good idea of the amount and sources of a governor's budget. I quote, Sir Leslie Rundell, well, I'm not going to quote this, because basically what he's saying is that he has an allowance of 1,000 years per annum, but that a carnival ball costs £500, and he says the War Office declined to contribute further, and Sir Leslie Rundell intends not to give the ball and anticipates unfavourable comment in consequence. Sir Leslie Rundell's proposal to be given more money was turned down, even though records show that Rundell had sent two applications for an increased allowance to cover ball expenses, pleading that this ball is not only a feature of the social life of the Maltese, but also a source of income to Maltese tradesmen and others. The Colonial Office agreed that the measure would make the governor unpopular, but the Army Council of the War Office were unmoved. The ball was held, a clear indication that the governor must have been aware of the fact that not holding the ball would have certainly seemed suspicious to the Maltese, not only because they maintained that the ball expenses were paid out from the Maltese treasury, but especially since the year before it had been cancelled for the official reason of the prolonged indisposition of Lady Clark, wife of Rundell's predecessor. This excuse, given in a particularly tense political situation, had been considered a pretext by the Maltese higher bourgeoisie, who were still smarting from the blow to their freedom by the removal of the 1887 constitution. A Maltese Italian language newspaper published a telegram from Malta that had appeared in the British newspaper Tribune on the 12th February 1907, where Lady Clark's illness was denounced as an excuse to hide the real reason for the cancellation of the ball. The cancellation was linked to a Maltese initiative to oppose the British-controlled government that had been put in place in June 1903. On the 23rd January 1905, a political group called Associazione Politica Maltese had been formed to elect a Consiglio Popolare, without obviously English approval, popular council, by suffrage, with the purpose of questioning the government's legitimacy and communicating authoritatively both with the local and the imperial governments. The members of the Consiglio had not been invited to the ball, an act which raised great public indignation and provoked people to call for the resignation and removal of the government's principal secretary. Probably the governor, fearing that the situation might degenerate further, decided not to hold the ball and produced the pretext of his wife's illness to save face. The reason for the suspension of the Palace Ball in 1900, the Boer War, which cost the British thousands of lives, had not left the Maltese indifferent. The official reason for the cancellation was the mourning of thousands of English families due to the war between the British and the Boers. This war brought out mixed sentiments on the part of the Maltese. On the one hand, Maltese people, including school children, had donated money to aid the families of those wounded in the war. Consequently, the governor had felt it appropriate to give the money that would have been spent for the Palace Ball, which is set at £200, to charitable institutions around the island as a gesture of gratitude for Maltese generosity. On the other hand, the war inspired nationalistic anti-British sentiment that was eloquently expressed in certain newspapers. The newspaper Malta, edited by Fortunato Mizzi, founder of the Anti-Reform Party, from which the Nationalist Party was to emerge, had started a polemical protest when its rival pro-British newspaper, the Daily Malta Chronicle, published the following statement, later to be denied by the police authorities. I quote, "No caricature or disrespectful representations regarding ecclesiastical and military matters will be allowed during the forthcoming 4 days of carnival." Right. Malta claimed that the reason for this false notice was that the Daily Malta Chronicle had heard that a satire about the Transvaal War was being prepared and feared that it would be well received. The newspaper advised that the satire should not be shown, but revealed its true leanings when it justified its stance by claiming that the misfortunes of others should be respected, even when they were well deserved. The newspaper Il Bandiera Talmaltin, edited by Manuel Dimek, who was even more virulently anti-British, as well as violently anti-clerical, described an episode that took place a few days after Carnival in mock pro-British terms. The author claimed that the Maltese people had prolonged the Carnival period when they had run around the streets carrying flags in their hands or around their necks, as well as medals on their chests. The twist to this initial description was provided by the information that since these flags were being sold as handkerchiefs, people began to blow their noses in them and tied them around goats' necks, the tails of horses, donkeys, or mules. Somebody in the palace square actually tied a flag around his dog's middle. In an addendum to the article, the author ironically underlined that the episode was not, in fact, a celebration of Carnival, but the expression of joy that the Maltese people had felt towards the English, because since the Boers had withdrawn from Ladysmith to defend Orange, the numerous English citizens who were locked in the city could get out, and therefore did not fall into Boer hands. The author's true sentiments were expressed even more clearly 2 years later, when in describing that year's carnival, he made reference to past celebrations by stating, I quote, "The extent of our pleasure was as great as our distress when we saw the Maltese people jump with joy because the savages of Europe," and he uses the word Slavaj, had got rid, the British it means, had got rid of the Boers in Ladysmith, and because they had entered Pretoria. The people really had nothing to rejoice about on that occasion. Calling the British savages was taking things to extremes. It echoed, however, the type of language used by some English to describe the Maltese. I now go on to public balls. Popular balls. In the case of the popular classes, the game for social assertion was again one of rank, but it was not played to affirm or negate power, but rather to claim status. Unlike the balls at the palace or the three other main venues, Borsa, Union Club and Casino Maltese, where people could accede only by membership or invitation, everyone who could afford to pay the entrance fee could attend popular balls. This form of entertainment continued to develop for most of the 20th century, especially just before and after World War II, where more and more places advertised carnival balls, such as the Anglo-Maltese League, the Metro Dance Hall, or later the Hotel Phoenicia in Valletta. Consequently, people did not go there to see and be seen or to be identified as belonging to Malta's elite. On the contrary, the popularity of these balls was also due to the fact that they provided a space where social and class distinctions became blurred, even if just for the space of an evening. As we shall see, the development of these balls allowed for social classes to mix, also thanks to the costumes worn, and especially the masks covering the faces, thus hiding identity and producing a privileged moment where class distinction was not as heavily underlined as in everyday life. Moreover, the common people did not cause the same concern to the British as the power-seeking Maltese bourgeoisie. Unlike their superiors, British soldiers shared the same places of amusement as the Maltese, above all drinking bars and eventually dance halls, particularly during the carnival period. Alongside the official high society balls, the common people also held their own carnival dances. Not much mention is made of them in 19th century newspapers. In 1893, a public ball in Balsunetta, a rather shaded district in Floriana at the time, gets into the papers because it becomes the site of a crime passionnel. 4 years later, various balls, both for children and adults, are advertised at the Melita Club in Valletta. Given the appearance and amount of publicity in the papers, it would seem that at the turn of the century, soirée dansante became popular with the middle classes and veglioni with both upper and lower classes in Malta. The most important balls were the ones given at the two main theatres in Valletta, the Royal Opera House and the Manuel Theatre. The ball at the Royal Opera House was attended by the governor after balls were no longer given at the palace. Balls also began to be held in band clubs such as the King's Own and La Valette clubs, situated at the main streets of Valletta, known as at the time as Strada Reale. The popularity of the celebrations in the band clubs was to become such that they were to provide serious competition for those at the Royal Opera House. As a 1936 newspaper states that attendance at the latter theatre had been very poor on the previous Sunday because the clubs in Strada Reale were running their first carnival dances. Other venues later sprung up, such as the St. George Overseas Club. Soirées dansantes were also given in political clubs, such as that of the Giovine Malta, which had been the scene for the formation of the Associazione Politica Maltese I spoke to you about. The club had large, spacious rooms, which were decorated by the leading Maltese artists Ramiro Cali and Robert Caruana Dingley, who were also club members. The merriment lasted all night, and dancing went on from 9 p.m. to 4 a.m., and not 1 hour later than the end of the palace ball. Patrons attending these balls had the choice between carnival disguise and the ballroom gown. In the 1920s, the newspapers claimed that public balls had become so popular that they had emptied the streets of merriment in the evenings. The reason for their popularity was, according to one paper, due to the fact that, I quote, Whoever wants to have fun can do so in the balls at a much lower cost, and so to speak with the family, because it is easier to meet and spend time with relatives and friends here than in the street." End quote. Their importance was to grow steadily up to the late 60s, when carnival revelry was not complete unless one went to celebrate in one or more of the hotels that were newly developing. Balls at the Royal Opera House. Balls at the Royal Opera House started in 1912 and were unofficially inaugurated by the Governor General, who watched the celebrations from his lodge. The year following their inauguration, a newspaper gave the following report of the Royal Opera House balls. I quote, "The masked ball at the Royal Theatre was, however, very numerously attended. The richly decorated and brilliantly illuminated house looked very beautiful, especially in association with the gay company of costume dancers and spectators occupying the boxes. The dancing competition, which started on Thursday, was concluded on Saturday. Balls took place on all carnival days except Fridays. On Mondays, after attending the Palace Ball, palace guests would continue to celebrate at the Opera House from about midnight, mixing with the less affluent and adding to the general brio. People could choose between wearing a ball dress, especially if taking part in the dance competitions, or fancy dress. Both theatres offered prices for costumes, but newspaper protests show that some confusion was at times made in the attribution of prizes, and that in one case, a Mr. Selvaggi carried away the prize for a man in female dress, first from the Manuel and then from the Royal Opera House. Masks were only allowed at the Royal Opera House in 1933, and in places where they were permitted, masked figures had to allow themselves to be recognized upon entering. The mask was a primary means to allow for the mix of classes, and permission to wear it is seen as a colonial acknowledgement of the people's social maturity, as is pointed out in The Freeman. And there is a quote which basically talks about masks as protecting the prestige of the upper classes, who are apt to descend to follies which are perhaps not quite in accordance with their social position, whilst the poor and lowly have a chance under the mask to rise above their social condition and to feel that at least once in a year they are equals to their betters. After the palace balls came to an end, the Royal Opera House became the venue for the official carnival balls. The Civil Service Ball and later the Dockyard Carnival Ball were both held there. A description of the Civil Service Ball held at the Opera House in 1935 indicates that the large space enabled more guests than ever before to attend. It was presided by the Governor Sir David and Lady Campbell, who were attended by a Maltese colonial ADC, Captain Salomone. By this time, the question of costume had long been solved, and Sir David's costume consisted of a scarlet coat and black knee breeches, while Lady Campbell wore a costume of the Tudor period. The ball on opening night saw Lord Mountbatten disguised as a cowboy. The Times of Malta informs that on that occasion, the national anthem was played upon His Excellency's appearance in the box, certainly referring to the British anthem, as the Maltese national anthem was only recognized as an official anthem in 1941, even though it had been composed in 1922. In 1934, English and Maltese had been made official languages of Malta, and Italian had been completely removed from the civil service and school curricula. Meanwhile, since 1932, when its constitution had yet again been revoked, Malta was under direct government, and this political state of affairs was to last until 1947. Carnival, therefore, did not only allow for the mix of classes, but it also permitted persons who were politically opposed to each other to spend a pleasant evening in each other's company. Both in the 19th and early part of the 20th centuries, people wandered the streets or attended balls in companies, and this sometimes led to what was called roughhousing, especially when parties discovered that they had chosen the same disguises. The 1935 ball at the Opera House contained two big parties, the Devonshires in smocks and sunbonnets and the Alice in Wonderland party. However, I quote, "There was practically no rough housing This was due, no doubt, to the absence of the many big parties dressed alike. Usually there are many such parties, and when Greek meets Greek, or shall we say Cossack meets Costa, then someone's in for trouble. As it was, everyone was very well behaved. End quote. The popularity and attendance of the Valletta balls was such that public transport to the main villages and towns of Malta at the end of the balls was provided. This reflected the popularity of performances at the Royal Opera House, where public transport back home was also made available, a provision that regretfully was to end when private cars began to proliferate on the island. When the dances in Slema began to develop, people from the three cities could also avail themselves of public transport that was specifically organized. Other public balls. Public balls did not only take place in Valletta. In 1914, balls were also taking place in other parts of the island, in spite of the gloomy predictions following the inauguration of the ball at the Royal Opera House, which had said that basically all these balls were going to end. Balls were certainly held in the neighbouring town of Slema, which not only boasted a theatre to house them, the Teatro Vittoria, but also a cinema, the Duke of Edinburgh, run by the Axisa family, only 9 years after the first motion picture cinema had opened in America. In the 1930s, new venues were opened, such as the Queen's Hall or the Gaiety Theatre. Balls also took place in the three cities facing Valletta, where carnival celebrations vied with those of the capital in public participation and brio. And in 1923, mention is made of Vapura in Bormla and Mably and Gambin in Lisla, the latter probably being venues belonging to the two families. Balls at the famous cinema theatre, the Rialto, started in 1936, and further south at the Trops Hall in Paola. An article appearing in 1937 provides a good description of the importance that balls had assumed all over the country. I quote, "After the war," the First World War, obviously, "big theatres opened in every big town and even in the villages, principally for cinema or talkie shows. During Carnival, these theatres emulated the Royal Opera House management and started veglioni of their own. Today, these form the principal attraction for town and country people alike. Hence, the gradual decline of Carnival as it used to be and the renaissance these recent years through the valued cooperation of the Carnival Committee and the help of those who contribute towards the expenses and cost of prizes." End quote. At the turn of the century, a newspaper criticized Carnival celebrations, stating that these were not as brilliant as in past times, and listing various elements which posed a threat to the festivities. One essential reason was certainly the economic crisis, but the principal reason was, I quote, "that today we can enjoy ourselves all the year round and at a low price, because thanks to cinemas, cafes, theatres, to trips and travels abroad and other celebrations, the public in general has many opportunities to enjoy itself and does not think of saving up money for the Carnival festivities." I'm going to end by giving you a little glimpse after the war. The appropriateness of holding balls, both in clubs and private parties, came under discussion during World War II, when Malta came under heavy bombing. The only trace of a dance being held in this period is in 1943 at 11 Paula Street, Tarshin, and the celebrations are restricted to the service personnel belonging to the 3rd Battalion of the King's Own Malta Regiment. In 1944, when attacks were less frequent, they had practically disappeared, Carnival revelry could be seen once more and created a welcome break after years of fear and destruction, which had also seen the destruction of the prime venue for balls, the Royal Opera House, in April 1942. People tried to celebrate its style, and costumes brought colour to the streets. Moreover, I quote, "hooch supplies," I don't know what hooch supplies were, "mysteriously appeared for Carnival. Dances were numerous and well attended. Even Valletta bus termini got lit up for that occasion." The popular appeal of the balls was perhaps one of the reasons that encouraged Maltese politicians after the war, the Second World War, to take an active part in them, first through the presence of their wives and later through their own. They were probably considered an excellent venue for public visibility, which in political terms could be translated into popularity and ultimately votes. In 1949, Mrs. Boffa, wife of the Maltese Prime Minister and leader of the Labour Party, Paolo Boffa, presided over the judging at a grand competition during a carnival ball held at the Fenicia Hotel. The hotel had become a prime venue for carnival celebrations, especially after the Opera House had been bombed down. 2 years later, the Federation of Malta Industries, founded in 1946, held its first carnival ball at the Fenicia, which was attended by 400 guests that included the new Prime Minister, George Borchgrevink, who headed the Nationalist Party, and his wife Alexandra. Political parties also held their own carnival balls, and in 1960s, Dr. Borchgrevink presided over the Nationalist Party balls at the Radio City Opera House. The Labour Party had held a grand ball at this venue just after the war on the 14th February 1947, and at that time, the Radio City Opera House had become the most important theatre in Malta. In 1956, when government had passed into the hands of the Labour Party, José Lul Mercer, Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Works and Reconstruction, distributed carnival prizes at one of the reputed modern cinemas of the time, the Ambassador Cinema in Valletta, which, like the other cinema venues all over the island, was turned into a grand ballroom for carnival celebrations. In the 1960s, the popularity of carnival balls was such that companies competing in the dances on the square would attend the balls and compete with their dances at the balls themselves. After independence, political tampering with carnival in the 70s brought carnival balls to a halt.
Thank you very much, Vicky. I'd just like to open up with one question. It's very interesting that there were so many balls in the 19th century. There must have been a huge expenditure by upper-class Maltese on these balls. And even the ironic reference to one a day. I mean, a very great difference from more recent times.
Yeah. Basically, balls were really a focus of attention, and we noticed that they cost a lot of money for the families through the descriptions of the costumes, because the costumes were really rich. I mean, incredibly rich. Whether they were fancy dress costumes or ball gowns, the descriptions speak of silks, of taffeta, of all sorts of materials which were really expensive and also very complicated. Like, for example, interesting that one carnival ball shows the governor's wife appearing as a Maltese lady. So probably it was Maltese 18th century lady, you know, which obviously required a lot. So yes, there was a lot of expenditure, and also we know that the refreshments were very good. There was a lot of refreshments, a lot of food was given. Obviously, there were the orchestras. It's interesting to see when waltzes come in, because obviously waltzes at the time were very daring, and polka was even more daring because ladies showed their ankles. So, you know, that meant that you had pretty nearly turned out shoes and proper silk stockings to show. You know, so, yes, that's quite true.
Congratulations. That was very interesting. For two or three reasons. First, it's a window from which to look at society and politics. But it's also another window from which to look at popular festival, because it is a more secular festival than the typical festa celebrations and the band marches and so on. It raises many questions. For instance, one can easily understand the rivalry, the racism and so on, the competitions between the clubs, the poking fun at somebody like Inglot, who had been sent by the English on a scholarship to England and obviously made the head of department and so on, and his clogs and so on, which is actually... But is there implied in this something even more disturbing? And that is a low self-esteem and possibly an inverse racism. For example, when you discuss the fear of being seen as Zeppo, that is to say, the fear of being seen as a Maltese, I don't know how you would place this. And you make many references to 1935 as well. Now, 1935 in Malta, I don't know how this comes out in the carnival balls, but 1935 in Malta is a time of intense repression,
of
bordering on terrorism.
Of course, yes. Definitely. It's interesting. I think your question is a very interesting one, because I think we can answer that through the imagery. In the sense, if you look at images of Maltese society that are given in some of the British newspapers, when they are English, when they are English events, you know, like the arrival of some king or, well, not king, but duke or whatever, you have Maltese and English ladies dressed in the pink of fashion with parasols and, you know, and English costume. When Maltese society is being depicted, then what is often shown is in the newspapers, I'm talking about the British, pro-British newspapers, is men dressed in poorer clothing or women with onella. And rarely, more rarely do we see women, you know, the high society women, after all, in Malta, who are beautifully dressed. We see high society women more in paintings rather than in the illustrations from newspapers. Now, I am distinguishing between the two because the illustrations from newspapers are popular. You know, people buy newspapers, everybody buys newspapers, or at least people can read them, whilst paintings hang in houses. So there is an iconography. And also, it is important to read the legends underneath this iconography to determine what is happening and the attitudes that are being taken. I think one thing I one day need to study, but I haven't had time for it anyway, and I'm not at the National Library at the moment, is the fact that I'd like to see, according to, you know, historical evolution and the incidents that were happening in Malta, how the kind of evolution of imagery in the newspapers, you know, because I'm sure there is a change. I'm sure there are shifts, but I can't prove it now because I haven't studied it. But I think it's worth looking into to start with. In 1935, yes, you are right. This was a time of great repression and tension, and people were protesting in the streets. So what is interesting is that in all this, there is a carnival ball, and it's being held, and people are going to it. So, you know, it's as though people allow themselves to let their hair down in carnival. So. Yeah.
Congratulations, Vicky. That was wonderful. And all those sources. I mean, I'd like to see the whole paper, and amazing work. But one of the things I was thinking of was, firstly, whether it might also be interesting to get some oral histories from people who are quite old, you know, who still remember at least the 1920s, 1930s, because just hearing family members talking about carnival and carnival balls. Obviously, this was the build-up would have taken about 6 months. Mm-hmm. A company practicing, choosing a theme, a dance, making costumes. So I think there was a lot more going on, just in terms of social interaction between the Maltese themselves. And related to that, I take very well your point about the sort of the dominant discourse of the British and the way of controlling and showing who's boss, which
more
determining
in the 19th than
yes
in the
19th, but who's boss to determining what you should be wearing for the ball. But I wonder whether you could also ask, were the balls a way that Maltese high society was showing, indicating to each other what roles and ranks they had, independent of the British colonial power, the first? And secondly, when the new Maltese clubs started, like Casino Maltese, etc., were they excluding the British elite? Did they use the clubs in a way to sort of turn the table, so to speak? Or who was being invited?
No.
Who went to the Casino Maltese ball? Did all the top high-ranking British officials go?
Well, I think your point about oral history is a very important one. And you're right, you are perfectly right, but I've been living abroad since I started this research, so I haven't been able to meet Maltese.
Get some students to do it.
I think you're right. And secondly, however, with regard to Maltese, I think that's a very interesting point, and it's a very good one, actually. It's true. People had to show to each other. But I think it's a very valid point. With regard to who the Maltese clubs were inviting, it's not always said in the newspapers, and there are traces of British presence, but I have to do more research into that. I'm not sure, because what I found about the Casino Maltese is that the Maltese are really praising themselves about the ball and the quality and the dances and this and that and the other. Whilst we really get to know who is there at the governor's ball at the palace. That is the one where we really know. We could actually establish a list of names thanks to the costumes that are published in the newspapers. So I can't quite answer that.
I'd like to take up again the theme of expenditure. Is there any contemporary equivalent of the amount of money being spent by people of some wealth on what we might call pure celebration, a kind of pure social celebration? Do we have any equivalent to that in
Well, Paul,
in
if you look
Malta?
At carnival costumes, carnival costumes which are spent by the now this time by the dancing companies. This year I couldn't come for carnival, but last year I made it a point to book my leave for carnival, and I came, and I was amazed by some of the costumes and the cost that some of the costumes must have represented. Now I know that costume costs can be affronted only because many of the carnival people make their own costumes. I mean, their wives and their girlfriends make the costumes, etc., etc. And frankly, this is a little parenthesis I want to open. I pronounce myself publicly against the fact that we are removing the places where floats are being made from Valletta because of space, etc., etc. Because what I think we are doing is we are destroying a social tissue, which is basic social fabric, which basically at the root of this carnival, where people who live for carnival live close by to where they produce their carnival floats. Their wives can check on them, their girlfriends can date them, and they can all go, and the children can go and watch them do the carnival floats, and they can participate in the making of the carnival floats, and eventually they themselves are going to want to make the floats, etc., etc. And I think that this also has to be taken into consideration. I think this is dangerous, because if these people who are enthusiasts and to produce carnival floats, which are far beyond what we pay them for through the prizes, stop, our carnival will stop. And I personally, being a lover of carnival and thinking it is one of the greatest things we have and we don't realize it, also because of some inverted snobbery, think that these things need to be protected, and destruction of social fabric has shown us in the past, when we began to tamper with carnival, that it means slow destruction and slow disinterest. And I think it is very important that these anthropological studies proper be made before we start playing around with them. Even though I recognize that there is very little or no space in Valletta, but I don't know where and how to find it or how to invent it, but I think it's important to think of that.
Proset, Vicky, don't you think that this, what you just mentioned now, these decisions that are taken with respect to stem from the fact that we have a lack of performance research, of the Maltese, the way the Maltese perform, the performative nature of our culture. I don't think it's coming from there. Also, this.
I think so. I think it is very much due to this, because for a very long time, the notion of performance. There were people who have fought this all through the years. I'm thinking, in particular now of Francis Ebeye, but people who have said that performance, who have wanted to put performance on professional lines, and also not just performance with regard to, you know, performance on the stage, but also performative behavior. Well, I have tried to do a lot of field work with students on performative behavior. We used to do field work on carnival, we used to do field work on festas, we used to do field work on many. And in order really to create an awareness among the young of what performative behavior is all about. But I think, I think you are right. I think what needs to be done is not to convince the intelligentsia, because today I think members of a certain type of intelligentsia, among people here, after all, are convinced of the importance of performative behavior in Malta. I think what needs to be, the people who need to be convinced are decision makers as to the importance of recording and preserving the conditions to allow this performative behavior to take place, not to determine the performative behavior itself. And this is where the mistake is made, because what happens is that legislation starts determining behavior. In fact, at the moment, I'm doing a lot of research with regard to the rules, because if there's one thing I cannot stand, it is rules, particularly in carnival. When I became part of the Carnival Commission in Malta, there were 146 rules. And I said, after 146 rules, which somebody probably has broken one of them, because you don't even know what your 146 rules are, you've basically quenched all spontaneity. And I think that what should be preserved is the conditions, but not the behavior, but not the way things should be happening. That is up to the people to decide by their own behavior. What should be ensured is guaranteeing the conditions that this can take place. And then how they do it is up to them, and not up to people who don't even know anything about it and who understand nothing about it, or who don't care to go and write down what they're supposed to be doing, you know?
In fact, it's...
No, it's not censorship. It's wanting... It's overzealousness, actually. It comes from good intentions very often, because, you know, to help them. But helping needs qualification, you know? And I don't think we always understand that.
Half question and half comment is, don't you think that there was a certain kind of trying to regularize through rules carnival in the 70s?
Well, unfortunately, it happened
before. Similar to what is happening now with festas, with the church is trying to do the same thing that happened in the 70s.
Yeah, but we have a national obsession, you know, to organize people's lives. So, you know,
everybody's happy.
I mean, you know, I believe very much in paideia, which is let people do what the hell they like, and then just create the conditions for them to do what the hell they like, and let them go away with it.
Just a very brief intervention. Well, first of all, very well done. And secondly, just to lay your mind at rest that luckily, once people have consumed adequate quantities of hooch, they would normally completely disregard 146 rules.
No, Vicky, that was very fascinating. Just going back to the historical dimension of this, you tend to indicate that and that's the sequence you followed. You started with the British balls, and then you moved to the imitation balls by the Maltese aristocracy, and then the dissemination of these practices into other villages. Is this because this was actually the way balls evolved here? You also mentioned in the beginning that there was a tradition with the knights of organizing balls. So no, was there a popular tradition there which maybe disappeared?
No, there probably was, but there is no trace of it. I haven't found documented trace of it, but I've been looking for it in various newspapers. But newspapers didn't start immediately in 1800. This is the point already. They started later, and Maltese-speaking newspapers started even later. So I am looking for that. But also, I don't know whether they would have been written about. This is the trouble. And I'm trying to look at sources now, other sources, like, for example, travelers, travelers. And one thing I have to look at, but there I have to be in Malta again, I have to go to the notarial deeds and look at court cases. Because in court cases, you get what was happening. But I need to be in a Maltese library to do that. But that's my next intention, to go and try and see whether I can discover court cases of brawls or this sort of thing during Carnival, and maybe that can give me the one sentence I need to get an idea about what was happening.
Thank you very, very much, Vicky, for a fascinating paper, and I'm sure the audience looks forward to your next paper on Carnival. Thank you very much.
Thank you.